Welcome to Blue Dot, a look at our place in space. I'm Dave Schloem. Recently, I was a guest on a fly fishing podcast, and one of the guides who was involved, Matt Squillante, contacted me later to tell me about a friend of his who was a shark researcher, wondering if I might like to have him on Blue Dot. Turns out he's not just any shark researcher, but one of the world's foremost authorities on the subject. So I jumped on the chance to contact and invite David Ebert, also known as the Lost Shark Guy on the Discovery Channel Shark Week, and he kindly agreed to join us to share his passion for these often misunderstood and vitally important creatures in ocean ecosystems. Dr. Ebert is the program director for the Pacific Shark Research Center at San Jose State University's Moss Landing Marine Laboratories. He's also the author of several books on sharks, including Sharks of the World, A Complete Guide. As we'll hear, he's discovered many species of sharks around the world, and he's going to share his love for these mysterious denizens of the undersea world by joining us now. David Ebert, welcome to Blue Dot.
Well, thanks, Dave. Glad to be here.
So great to have you, because sharks are just, they're one of those, I call them a gateway drug to science. If you're interested in marine science, you know, sharks and whales are a way to get people interested. Yep. And so what I'd like to know from you is, I believe you got interested in sharks at a very early age. Tell us about that.
Yeah, I was about 5 years old, and my parents gave me a book on sharks. And it was just a basic early book. This is, back in the 1960s when we knew nothing about sharks. And I just thought these things were like the coolest things I'd ever seen. And, when you're 5 years old, sharks, dinosaurs, whales, everybody's kind of cool about, oh, that's kind of neat. And so, but I was just fascinated by them. Well, you think, okay, most kids sort of grow out of it after, a few years, you go on to the next stage of life. Well, when I was about 10 years old, I was still fascinated by these things. And I just thought, I told my parents, I want to find some way. I want to study sharks and I want to travel around the world and I want to get paid for that. And my parents were like, yeah, okay, that's great. That's cute, Dave. That's great. That's a good idea. Glad you got something to go for.
You'll outgrow that.
I'll grow that. No problem. I'm only 10 years old, so they don't really think about it. So it kind of went along. I just stayed focused. I just never grew out of that fascination. And in fact, I was my senior year in high school, before I, kind of your last sort of semester so before you graduate, your guidance counselor had you come around and, so what do you plan to do, Dave, after you graduate high school? And I was like, well, I'm going to go to college and I'm going to get my a degree in biology and then I'm going to travel around the world to study sharks. And he's sitting there looking at me like, uh-huh, that's great. I'm glad you have a good ambition. Have you thought
about plan B?
Yeah, exactly. And that was his exact words. He goes, do you have a plan B in mind? I kind of looked at him bewildered, like, no, not really. I just plan to do the shark thing. And he's like, okay, well, good. I hope that shark thing works out, but you really might want to give some thought to a plan B. And the funny, interesting thing is I saw this guy, because I used to pop around my high school once in a while, but about 10 years later, after I'd done a master's degree and I was getting ready to go start a PhD on sharks, I ran into him. And I started talking with him and I said, do you remember me telling you I wanted to go study sharks? And he goes, oh yeah. He goes, yeah, of all the thousands of kids I had come through, I think you're the only one that ever said you're going to go study sharks. And I said, well, what'd you think about that? And he says, and I always respected him for this. He goes, I see so many kids coming through here and they're graduating high school. They have no idea what they're going to do. They're going to suddenly be out in the world. They have no idea. You had a direction. And he goes, I admittedly didn't think the shark thing was going to work out, but I figured you had some direction where you're going to go and you'll figure it out as you went along. And I always respected him for that because, he could have could have made some comments like the shark thing's not going to work out. What the hell are you thinking about? But he was not discouraging at all. When I was in high school, he said, well, good luck on that. And then when I saw him years later, I thought he was very, very nice, very complimentary and stuff. So I always had a lot of respect for that guidance counselor there.
And where did you grow up?
I grew up in the Monterey area, in a little area called Pruneville.
That will definitely lead to an interest in the ocean, because I can't think of a more beautiful place to encounter the ocean than there.
Oh, yeah. And I mean, I was always around the ocean growing up there. I mean, my father taught me how to free dive when I was 8 years old out at Lover's Cove. Just literally had a mask. Of course, you're 8 years old. You don't need a wetsuit. You need a wetsuit. I just got a bathing suit. I don't need anything else like that. Of course, everybody else is wearing a wetsuit. But I was just so fascinated. It was so neat to put on a face mask. I still remember and just seeing all these fishes and little algae growing around out there. And it was just fascinating. And just, if anything, it spurred my interest more to want to study the marine environment and the sharks in particular.
Yeah, I had a similar kind of experience growing up where my sister and brother-in-law had a house in north of Malibu, and used to teach me how to you know, function in the ocean and appreciate it. And I loved it so much. And I remember a neighbor catching a small shark and just being fascinated by, you know, he was surf fishing and caught a shark and just looking at it going, oh my, those are out there. And then one Friday night, they took me to go see a movie at the Santa Monica Civic Auditorium called Blue Water, White Death.
Oh, yeah.
And it was about, you know, great white sharks. And then, you know, this was preceded Jaws, of course. So that's what kind of got me. I've always found sharks fascinating.
Yeah, no, I was about probably 12 or 13 when I remember seeing Blue Water, White Death. And I talk about it on my podcast quite a bit. I tell people, if you haven't seen this, and particularly young people, go watch this. I mean, it's kind of, as you know, Dave, it's by today's standards, it's a bit rough, but you can.
So cool.
But it's so cool because a lot of people that became really well known, like, well, Rod and Valerie Taylor.
Yeah.
Peter Gimbel, Stan Waterman, a whole bunch of these guys. And it was so unique at that time because they actually went out to film a great white shark rather than like catch it, which, as you know, back at that time in the 70s, it was like the big thing was go catch a white shark or catch a shark of any kind. But here they actually tried to film it. And you just see a whole different era before the whole Jaws thing exploded onto the scene.
Yeah. And we'll get to that a little later, but I'd like to just start with some Shark 101 for folks out there who maybe not familiar with sharks. So let's start out with, you know, where they fit in the evolutionary timescale. Like, they're ancient fish, aren't they?
Yeah, yeah. Some of the lineages go back, you know, about almost 400 million years. In fact, one of the lineages, when you think about sharks, I always kind of want to kind of preface this with people. Like, there's sharks, what most people think of as typical sharks, like a white shark or a tiger shark or something. And there's a whole array of other, quote, shark-like species that are, you know, some don't get any bigger than the palm of your hand. They're actually quite small. But there's also these other, what are really sharks, or what are called rays and skates. And that's really what, if you take a typical shark and you flatten it, that's basically what a ray is. It's just a flat shark. And what unites them is they have a cartilaginous skeleton.
So they don't have a bony skeleton like, you know, the typical fish.
Yeah, like a salmon or a rockfish or a halibut. Those are all bony fishes. And the sharks, though, and again, when I say sharks, I'm also referring to the rays. And I'm also referring to what we call ghost sharks. They're also known as chimeras or radfish. And again, what unites all of these three is they all come from a common ancestor. And the chimeras, or again, ghost sharks, I like to call them, they're united because they have a cartilaginous skeleton. And the earliest ancestors of these go back about 400 million years ago. And so you see different groups were more prolific at different times. Most of the modern groups that you see today, I don't want to get too off in the weeds with people, but most of the modern types of sharks you see, they basically started between 100 and 150 million years ago, some of the current lineages. So you had some different ebbs and flows over the years, but as a group, the sharks have persisted for about 400 million years.
Yeah, they're quite fascinating and ancient. And they also have those iconic gill slits. Could you tell us a bit about those?
Yeah, well, this is always something early on when I kind of started learning a little bit about sharks, is that all sharks have five gill slits. And if you ever like looking at some paintings or drawings of people, look at the number of gill slits, because you can tell how good the artist is, or get a little sense of the artist if they have five gill slits or if they have three or four, because oftentimes they'll put a few less in there. But there are a few species of sharks that have six gills, and there's two species that actually have seven gill openings. But that's, you're talking like a handful of species, like, you know, maybe 10 or so species out of the 1300 species of sharks and rays known. Yeah, so they have the gills, and basically the water flows over the gills. And people think like, well, sharks have to always be swimming. That's kind of a myth out there. And some types of sharks do need to keep moving they have what's called ramjet ventilation, where they got to have water flow over the gills. But a lot of the species, in fact, the majority of them can actually sit on the bottom. In fact, a lot of them are what they call benthic dwellers. They stay on the bottom, and they like things like an angel shark or something. They literally lay on the bottom. There's other species that'll rest in the bottom. So contrary to popular mythology, they don't need to have to be swimming all the time to survive.
Yeah, because you think about rays, they're often, you know, just sitting down there on the bottom.
Yep, absolutely. They're sitting there in the bottom, and their gills are actually, again, depending on the species, they can actually pump the water they need over the gill openings.
Let's touch on the iconic sharks, the ones that people know, the most popular ones, if you will. Yep. The great white shark is the one that most often comes to mind. Tell us a bit about them.
Yeah, well, you know, it's interesting because nowadays it seems like everybody, the big thing is like, ooh, let's go study white sharks and stuff. And they're one of what I call sort of the charismatic sharks. And that's because the things like, you know, movies like Jaws or Blue Water, White Death, and a whole host of other films and documentaries, they feature these things. And of course, you know, if you grow up, you know, along the California coast at all, you know, they're one shark. If there's usually a shark attack, it usually involves one species. Not always, there's a few exceptions, but it's mostly like it's the white shark. And then of course the movie Jaws kind of brought out a lot more fame of it, but essentially you have like a large, you know, shark that gets 15, 20 feet in length. And, you know, people are always trying to say like, well, is something 15 feet or 18 feet or 20 feet? And let me tell you, when it gets over 10 feet, it's a big freaking shark. You know, my personal attitude, if it's more than, you know, I'm about 6 foot tall, if it's over 6 feet, it's like, it's a big shark for me, and I'll give it kind of a wide berth and get out of the water. If depending on the species, if it's a white shark, but yeah, but they get big. They occasionally, they do bite people. There've been certainly a number of recorded attacks by white sharks and stuff, but it's like, if you go to, you know, parts of the US to Alaska, you know, you go out in the woods, you might run into a grizzly bear. You know, and that, you know, just because you see one doesn't necessarily mean it's going to attack you. That's the same with a white shark. I mean, it's just because one might be by doesn't mean it's going to necessarily attack you. In fact, people I know spend a lot of time around them, you know, they'll tell you like, well, it's the ones you worry about are the ones you don't see. Because if you see them, they're probably just cruising by, checking you out, and they're not in a stealth, more of a stealth or a hunting mode with that. But, you know, even things like the white sharks today, as I say, they're very popular. But back in the day, you go back 30, 40 years or, you know, to the 70s, 80s, and the 90s, we knew nothing about white sharks. I can remember going, I went to do my PhD in South Africa in kind of the mid, late 80s. And at the time, some of the people down there, it was kind of well known, well, these sharks breach. And I go, what do you mean they breach? They said, well, these white sharks, they'll come up blasting out of the water. And I couldn't believe this. These sharks were actually breaching. Now, this was still in, like, say, the late 80s. Well, a few years after I had left South Africa in the 90s, a fellow named Chris Fallows was a friend of mine. I didn't know him at the time, but he went out in False Bay there and actually filmed these white sharks breaching, and you know, became, you know, world famous, and, you know, and did very well, you know, being able to show these white sharks breaching. And it was kind of funny because when I was living in South Africa and I'd seen these sharks do this breaching behavior, I'd tell some of my professors back in California, and they'd be like, yeah, sure, Dave. Like, how much beer did you have? And I says, no, seriously, I wasn't drinking or anything. That these sharks can really come out of the water. Well, a few years later, after Chris's video started coming out, people were going like, hey, Dave, did you know these white sharks breached? And I'm like, yeah, I kind of told you this like 5 years ago. You guys thought I was nuts or something. But apparently it was one of these things that was well known, but people lived along the coastal areas in South Africa were aware of it. It's just, it wasn't really well known to the world until, you know, Chris and others started filming it.
Yeah. And sharks' teeth are also very iconic. Mm-hmm. Especially if you look back into the history of paleontology, sharks' teeth were, you know, one of the first things that were like, oh, you know, these things have been in the ground a long time, or in these rocks. Mm-hmm. And it's interesting about sharks that are they able to reproduce their teeth? Like, you know, can you tell us about how that works?
Yeah, they're actually, the teeth are kind of like a modified scale. They have dermal denticles, the sharks have, they're kind of modified, and they're constantly replacing themselves. So a shark will go through thousands of teeth, because if one breaks off, they just naturally drop off the teeth over time. And when you go through the fossil records you're talking about, the only thing really you find much about sharks are the teeth that are left over. Sometimes you might find some vertebrae with them, but because they're cartilaginous, it's really rare to find much of a shark outside their teeth, and occasionally you find vertebrae. Once in a while, in the right types of sediments, they'll be able to capture a bit of fossilize a bit of an image of one, but generally all that's left of them is the teeth. And so paleontologists, people that study the teeth, can look at the teeth closely and determine like what species it is. They can compare it if it's a modern form or if this was a species that's now gone extinct. The teeth are like the most noticeable thing that are left over. In fact, people a lot of times they'll see where they call this a megalodon, which is like kind of an ancestor of the great white shark. And, you know, some of those teeth are as big as your hand. And you know, some of those things, sharks probably got 45 to 60 feet in length. This is like a souped up white shark on steroids is as big as a school bus or bigger. And yeah, so those things, thank goodness, those things are still swimming around. But and even though contrary to what people often say that they are, those things have gone extinct. And we kind of know this because the food they mainly ate, a lot of the whales, they track this in the fossil record, the whales that they used to feed on went extinct. And as the modern whales evolved, the theory is these guys were not well adapted to be able to feed on the new, modern whales, and these megalodons went extinct. And they could trace this in the fossil record. And what you saw is as those things were disappearing, you saw the more modern white sharks start to evolve and become the dominant predator in the ocean.
Well, another iconic apex predator type of shark is the white tip shark, which you find out in the open ocean, whereas the great whites tend to hug along the coastlines. Yeah. You had an interesting experience, as I recall, while diving with white tips. And I wonder if you could share that with us briefly.
Yeah, this is one I kind of mentioned this earlier. We were looking for some deep sea sharks up off the South Africa Mozambique border when I was a graduate student, and it's hot. You're in the tropics up there, and you got these long lines fishing to try to find out what types of deep sea sharks are there. And you're talking like 1,500 meters deep, which, you know, 4,000 or 5,000 feet. So we just jump over the side of the boat, go like, oh, I was just jumping in the water. We went snorkeling around and we're messing around. Pretty much at that time, the entire Shark Brain Trust of Southern Africa was out on this research trip. And we're in the water, I don't know, an hour, and a half. And we finally get out of the water. Like, okay, let's hop out. No sooner than we got out of the water than all of these oceanic white tips came swimming under the boat. And we're standing there like just awestruck, thinking like, we just spent the last hour plus in the water, and these things, they didn't just suddenly show up, come swimming in from Australia or someplace. They clearly were in the water with us. And the visibility was very good. As I said, we were wearing face masks and just in snorkeling around. And no one, there's probably half a dozen of us, no one saw these sharks at all. And as soon as we got out of the water, they all came swimming under the boat. And all I could theorize was that they figured that, well, now that we're back in the boat, they're looking for us to toss some, you know, they're probably habituated to people throwing stuff over boats to feed on. Thankfully, they didn't look at the biologists or grad students in the water as being food at the time. So, and just to put it in the perspective, oceanic white tips are probably one of the four or five most dangerous sharks in the world in terms of attacking people, even though their populations in a lot of areas of the world have declined by as much as, you know, 80-90%. But they are very aggressive, and they can cause problems, but they tend to be out in the open ocean. So unless you're out in the open ocean like we were, you know, you're not as likely to encounter them that much.
We're going to take a short break, but stay with us. When we return, we'll continue our look at the undersea world of sharks with our guest, Dr. David Ebert, director of the Pacific Shark Research Center at the Moss Landing Marine Laboratories. I'm Dave Schloem, and you are listening to Blue Dot. And we're back, and thanks for listening to Blue Dot. Let's return now to our visit with Dr. David Ebert, Program Director of the Pacific Shark Research Center at San Jose State University's Moss Landing Marine Laboratories. And of course, we're talking about sharks, both large and tiny, around the world. There are a lot of different kinds of sharks. Do you know how many species of sharks we have identified, you know, as of now? How many are there?
Yeah, I can tell you that. We have right now it's about 1,1300 species of sharks. In fact, to be more specific, I think it's 1,295 to be specific. And I tell people when I give public presentations, I often will ask people, you know, like how many sharks you think there are? you know, people might say like, oh, 20, you know, somebody might throw out 100 or something. They're just sort of guessing around. And then I tell them there's like about 1,300 species. And they're just like awestruck, like, oh my gosh, I had no idea. And the thing is most of the sharks, about 80% of the shark species are less than 6 feet in length. In fact, about half the shark species don't get much longer than 3 to 4 feet in length. And as I mentioned, there's some sharks that you can literally hold in the palm of your hand. They're so small, and people often might not even recognize those as sharks.
And another interesting thing about that is I saw that kind of the rate of discovery that like from 1758 to, you know, 1899, right around 1900, you know, there was like 420 known species of sharks. Mm-hmm. But there's been a lot of sharks discovered, you know, fairly recently.
Yeah, yeah. Well, just you kind of put in perspective from when the modern taxonomy era started in 1758 to 1899, there was an average of about 3 new species described a year. And then from about 1900 to 1979, it averaged about 5 a year. Since 1980, you know, averaging more about like, you know, 10 or 11 a year. And over the past sort of 15, 20 years, since about 2008, we've been averaging about 15 or 16 a year. So rather than slowing down, we're actually discovering more new shark species than ever before.
And so, therefore, there are probably sharks out there yet to be discovered?
Yeah. In fact, you mentioned that. I just had my most recent one that I named was just published here on March 7th. That was a new species of ghost shark from the Andaman Sea off Thailand. And I right now I'm working on another sort of half a dozen new species, because the thing is, you know, finding them is kind of the fun part sometimes, like, oh, wow, I got something new. But the real work comes when you get back to your laboratory, and then you have to go through the whole process of doing measurements. You have to do comparative analysis on it. And nowadays, they also, if you have the opportunity, you can do some genetic studies on it. Then you have to write up a proper description of this. And then you have to go through a peer-reviewed process to get it published. So it's quite a bit of work. The finding is just the fun part, which is like maybe 10% of the whole process. Because the thing is, when you find one, you have to collect a specimen that's literally like an archive. And it goes into a museum. It's what they call like a holotype. And that's literally like, so if anybody comes along in the future and thinks they have something similar or close to it, but might be different, That's literally the specimen. They have to go back to that specimen to compare it. And then the publication, it's literally like a document, a historical document. Because when you name something scientifically, that'll be around. Like I tell my students that I work with on some of these things, they'll be, you know, your great-great-grandkids can come back and find this specimen and look at this document that you published. You know, their great-great-grandmother had published and realized like, wow, that name will always be associated with that species. So it's kind of cool in that sense when you look at it in a more of a historical context.
And how many species have you personally discovered?
I have 53 that I've actually named, but I have dozens more that I'm still working on right now. Because again, I should mention the thing of discovery is most of the time, you collect stuff, you think you might have something, you're not too sure. Once in a while, you'll have that sort of, as I say, eureka moment where you're like, oh yeah, that one's definitely different. But most of the time you'll get it, you go like, I think that one's different. And you'll go back and you do the analysis. And then before you go like, yeah, that's definitely different. You know, scientists, sometimes you tend to be a little, I don't know, a little dry, you know, not wanting to get too emotional in the field, like, okay, yeah, well, that might be different or something. But you do get those moments where you want to do cartwheels on the beach and everything. So it's which is kind of exciting.
You even have a couple of sharks that you have named after some family members, right?
Yep. Yeah. When my niece, Lana, graduated from University of San Francisco back in around, I don't know, about 10, 12 years ago, I named a species of shark called Lana's saw shark from the Philippines. And Lana was the first girl in our family to get her college degree. So it was kind of a very special moment for our family and everything. And it was kind of meant a lot to, you know, to me to do something special for her and stuff. And so that was very cool to do that. And then of course she has a younger brother, Austin. And so I had, you know, of course I had to name something after my nephew. And so I named another shark, a flat shark, after Austin, called Austin's guitar fish from off South Africa and Mozambique.
That's very cool. And you were talking about how you go about discovering sharks. And one of the things that I read about you is, and it occurred to me, is like, oh, well, that makes perfect sense, is the importance of fishing villages. Mm-hmm. And these people who have been fishing for generations in certain areas, talk about them as a resource for science for you.
Yeah, this is really, to me, has been like, was sort of an undiscovered thing, because you know, when you're a young person growing up, and everybody goes through this, you think like, oh, great, I'm going to be like, you know, blazing across the ocean, like in a boat with my dive gear and, you know, looking for all these like really cool marine animals and stuff. Well, as you kind of get on, you start moving into the real world and how things work. And what I did is I got onto working with fishermen. And when I started traveling around, going to a lot of the countries, I'd go to these different fishing villages and I just start documenting what I would see. And I talk to the local people. Now, in a lot of these places, they don't speak English. And so some places they do, and you'll find someone that speak English, but I work with local people that might be where they might be either at the time earlier in my career. And even now, like some might be graduate students or early career people. It might work for an NGO or even a government agency, but I work with local people there that know the customs. They know where to go. Cause I tend to go to the out of the way places that most people would not go to. They're off the beaten path. And a lot of what especially as my career has evolved, yeah, you know, I work with them to identify what's there, see what species are there. And then all that information, and again, I learn a lot of the local knowledge on what they're catching there. I talk with them about like, you know, have you seen this species or different? And a lot of times they won't know the scientific names, but if you show them a picture or something, they're like, oh yeah, we remember that one. And a good example is people are familiar with sawfish, for example. And sawfish is a flat shark. And outside the United States and Australia, these things have virtually vanished around the world in a lot of the countries. So they live in mostly in the tropical areas, and these are in developing countries. And I was fortunate, you know, in my career back in the late 80s, where I saw a couple of these things would get landed occasionally. And I thought, oh, that's kind of interesting. Well, now these things have been so heavily fished and taken out that, you know, like at places in East Africa, it's like a huge event if somebody actually sees one or catches one. And so that's the kind of stuff that I try to document. Again, I use a sawfish example here because it's something that most people can visualize what it is. But there's a whole host of other species that I call lost sharks, really, that people have not seen for decades in a lot of cases. And that's what I've really spent a lot of my time going around looking for these. And then during the course, that's when I actually find new species. And I never go out looking to find a new shark. I just go out there to document what's there, learn as much as I can from the villages. And the other thing too, when I go to these villages, like I mentioned a minute ago, it's like, you know, if I go out in a boat, I'm like one person on a boat hoping to see some sharks. If I go to some of these villages, I'll have 50, 60, sometimes 100 boats. And these are small boats. It's artisanal fishing. They'll be out every day fishing. And so I just kind of work my day around, like I'm going to be there when they come in from the fishing grounds. And I just walk through there. And so I essentially have like 100 fishermen out sampling for me every day. It's kind of, in a way, I kind of think about it. It's great. And it's real efficient. And you know, I build relationships with these people. There's some people I met 30, 35 years ago, I still keep in touch with today.
Yeah. It makes perfect sense because, you know, you're getting so many hundreds and hundreds of fishing hours out there where you wouldn't be able to do that on your own.
Right. Exactly. And the thing is, what they're bringing in, you know, a lot of the stuff is like, okay, that's kind of common, but you'll start to see things that are like, wow, we haven't seen this shark in like, you know, 35, 40 years. I didn't start out in my career to do that, but I started coming back and got a reputation early in my career. I was the guy who was finding stuff that people had not seen for sometimes up to 100 years or more. They had not seen a shark. And I was just going out, talking to fishermen and going places that people would not normally go to. And all this information, why it's important people to understand is these, again, what I call these lost sharks, these little known species, these are really the proverbial canaries in the coal mine, in that they're going to tell you more about the health of the marine environment in these areas than like a white shark or a tiger shark or these more charismatic things. Because, you know, obviously a white shark and a tiger shark, you're not going to miss those. You see one of those, you don't forget it. But they're not as common as some of these other species maybe once were. And when you see species, and again, I've gone to some of these places so many times now that I can talk to some of the fishermen that can remember me from 35 years ago. And they say, oh yeah, we don't catch these anymore because we have to fish deeper, or we have to fish here, we have to do this. And so I've been around long enough now that I know a lot of trends on what's going on there. And I see areas where things have been fished down or things have showed up. And so a lot of my mission now has been to try to bring awareness to people, like, you know, I come back home to North America, or, you know, other, like, you know, Europe and some places, or people like, just, these are just things they'll see on a documentary. And I try to raise awareness that these are the things we should be paying attention to, because they're going to, like, because most people don't think of these things as sharks. They don't really recognize them. And yet these things could be disappearing at a greater rate than, you know, white sharks are really generally pretty well protected globally. In most places, they're generally, there's a lot of conservation measures implemented. In fact, a bit of a side story, the first country in the world to implement a ban on targeting fishing white sharks was South Africa back in 1991. And I was actually involved in that as a grad student back in the day. And it was so revolutionary at the time. You know, people today think like, oh, we'll go do some conservation. Well, you have to think there was no field of shark conservation back at that time. And here we were developing this whole thing to restrict, basically ban white shark fishing and targeting. I should say targeting. You know, you catch them incidentally, that just happens. But you had some people that were targeting them, and what happened there is interesting story. It was actually the commercial fishing industry wanted the South African government, to develop a policy to restrict these guys from catching the white sharks, because at the time, the fishing industry was getting hurt because the seal population, which it has in a lot of areas, was growing rapidly, and they were eating a lot of the more commercially important fish. The one main predator that was keeping the seal population somewhat in check were the white sharks, and yet you had some guys out there that were targeting the white sharks for the jaws, because back at that time, they could get a lot of money for the jaws. And I'd like to highlight that, because people always tend to give, like, the fishing community like a negative connotation, yet here you had the fishing industry actually drove the whole process. And I was, as I said, I was a young grad student at the time. I look back on it now, just fascinating to have been very fortunate in my career to have been in such a place to actually contribute. My professor, Leonard Campagna, and I, we basically provided the scientific data that was used to develop the policy to ban the white sharks.
Yeah, we've come a long way in the way we view sharks. Because I remember as a kid, remember the TV show Flipper?
Oh, yeah.
It was like the kind of the classic Flipper episode was, you know, the kid would be swimming along and, oh, there would come a shark. And, you know, Flipper mm-hmm. would bash the shark to death. And, you know, it was kind of like the only good shark was a dead shark. You know, it was like, hey, Flipper killed the shark. And now it's like, well, no, we don't want to be killing all the sharks.
Right. Yeah. You know, the thing is, when the movie Jaws had a huge impact, before Jaws, and again, growing up along the coastal areas, you know, there'd be a shark attack here and there. And, you know, you just like, well, it'd be like a one day story, like, oh, a surfer or, you know, skin diver got bit by a shark, but it wasn't much of a story. After Jaws came out, as you know, it became like a huge, you know, every sort of shark attack or shark, somebody just saw a shark, it became like a huge story. And then of course they people point to the negative parts of it, that, you know, people went out and started having all these big shark hunts and everything. And certainly that stuff went on, but, you know, shark fishing was actually going on before Jaws came out. It just went on and nobody paid any attention. Of course, then after Jaws became a big thing, like, oh, we're going to go out and catch sharks. And certainly, you know, some of the negative stuff people talked about, you know, Peter Benchley later in his life got very involved in shark conservation. And I know he passed away in 2006 from cancer, but I've seen comments that he'd made, and more recently Steven Spielberg, about how they felt that the movie had a big negative influence on sharks. But really what the movie did is it brought sharks out of the shadows, because things like shark finning has been going on for hundreds of years. It did not just start after Jaws or more recently, and things like, you know, shark fisheries were going on. But from my perspective, what the movie really did, and if I had a chance to talk to Spielberg, you know, I just tell him, like, you know, what your movie did is it really laid the foundation for contemporary shark research. And I was really fortunate, because when the movie came out, I was in high school, but by the time I was kind of in college and then starting graduate school in the early 80s, people started asking questions like, well, how many species of sharks are out there? How old do sharks get? How many young do they have? Where do they breed? And so people started having all these questions, and I was in that sort of first generation of of young researchers. I refer to this as the Jaws generation of young researchers in the 80s. It just caught that wave of going out and doing shark research. And if, just to digress for a moment, if you remember, I told you when I was in high school in the 70s, my counselor, you know, wished me good luck on the shark thing. I was going into a field. There was no field of shark research when I was telling my high school counselor, I'm going to go do shark research. There was no field for it. It didn't really come along for another 5 or 6 years before the field really started up in earnest in the early 80s. And as I said, there's a whole group of us that came along. And the cool thing about that back then is if you could think like, hey, why don't we go look at this or look at that? You know, our professors were, a lot of them are really terrific people. And they say, well, that's a good idea. Why don't you go find out? Sometimes it would work and you're like, wow, this is really neat. Or sometimes it might flop and not go anywhere. But we're definitely inspired to go try different things. You know, and I think sometimes today that there's too many like roadmaps that, you know, for students that you have to, well, you got to do this. You can't do that. You can't, there's too much that almost a negative connotation. Whereas I was fortunate where they just said like, well, go, if you can think of it, go try it, give it a shot, see what happens. And so it was just a golden era of just being able to go out and do things that people had not even thought about before.
Well, to me, it's one of the great movies of all time. It's the ultimate fishing movie to me.
Yeah.
It's such a great story. It's so well acted and directed. There's the iconic scene where Quint retells the story of being on the Indianapolis. And for those listeners out there may not be familiar with this, tell us briefly about the story of the Indianapolis that he recounts.
Yeah, well, if I could just, again, put it in context, before Jaws came out, the, quote, field of shark research was really limited to shark attack and shark repellent. And that came out of World War II because you'd have, sailors and air pilots would be in combat or something. They would find themselves in the ocean. And one of the most biggest stories that came out of World War II was the USS Indianapolis, which dropped off what was the first atomic bomb that they dropped in Japan. And it was such a super secret mission that they were on complete radio silence. Well, on the return from after dropping off the bomb, they were torpedoed by a Japanese submarine. And about 900 of the 1,200 men on board went into the water. And of course, because it was a secret mission, nobody missed them or anything. And so over the next 4 or 5 days, these guys were in the water, and a lot of the stories that came back were a lot of these guys were attacked by sharks. Certainly some of them were attacked by sharks, but I know in interviews with some of the people there, that in addition to sharks, some of them had injuries that they succumbed to, dehydration, exposure and stuff. And it was fortunate any of them survived. And it was just happened to be a plane, reconnaissance plane flew by and saw all these guys in the water, and they were able to rescue about, I think it was a little over 300 ended up surviving out of 900 that went into the water. But because of that, there was such a fear of sharks. And to keep in mind, these are guys that had been in combat experience, but there was such a fear of sharks that the Navy for the next 40 years invested a lot of research into developing shark repellent. So if somebody went down in the water, they'd have a way that they would presumably keep sharks away. Well, what happened is they did a lot of research, and at the end of the day, they came up with any really good shark repellents. There was, you know, it didn't really work at the end, but a lot of the stuff they gave them, it gave the pilots didn't really know that. Say the Navy aviators thought, okay, well, if I take this shark taser, it'll keep the sharks away. Well, didn't always really work that way, but at least it gave them some satisfaction in the mind. But a lot of the shark research at that time would just basically stem from basically developing shark repellents and stuff. And that's why I say when Jaws came along after the movie, people started asking more questions than about, well, what's the latest shark attack? They wanted to know more about sharks. So that's was kind of a bit of the evolution and the whole, and the influence that Jaws had on the whole movie. And if you remember the movie, because I thought it was kind of a big monster movie when I saw it. Again, growing up around the water, I didn't, you know, sharks were around, you just knew that. But it was when the white shark jumps in the back of the boat and eats Quint. At the time, you just thought like, oh, these white sharks can't jump. What are they talking about? Oh, yeah. And of course, like, you know, 15 years later, I'm sitting here going like, oh my gosh, these sharks really can jump. So
And you have an interesting connection to that film because you know the guy who helped design the shark, yeah. Bruce. Yeah. Tell us just a little bit about that.
Yeah, it turns out that when I went to do my well, first of all, when I was doing my master's, I was working up in San Francisco Bay in the early mid 80s. And I got to know a guy there, shark researcher there at the Tiburon, what used to be the Tiburon Marine Lab, Leonard Campagno. And he was like the big name in the shark world at the time. And he'd actually just finished writing a book on sharks of the world, which was published in 1984. And it was actually funded by the Office of Naval Research, had to do with the shark attack stuff. But it turns out, if you watch the movie, the last credit that comes up, it thanks Mr. Leonard J.V. Campagno, Stanford University. And that guy later became my professor in the late 80s for my PhD. And which this is another interesting story I mentioned earlier. I said, my dream in life was to travel the world and study sharks. And I just kept that goal going. And what happened is Leonard was actually from San Francisco. And I met him when I was doing my master's studying sharks in San Francisco Bay. And he got a job offer to go to South Africa. And this is about 1986 or so. And I went up to say goodbye, have lunch with him, and saying goodbye. And I kind of just as a off-the-cuff comment said, like, well, you know, if you need anybody to carry your bags, let me know. You know, it's a kind of throwaway statement. You think like, you know, good luck, you know, hope to see you again sometime. Well, about 8 months later, he calls me up from South Africa and says, hey, Dave, I have a PhD post here. Would you like it? And within like a nanosecond, I was like, yeah, when can I come? And so here I was, you know, about 26 at the time. And I'm like, great. I'm going off to fulfill my lifelong dream to travel the world and study sharks. And I'm getting paid for it.
That's amazing. You're like the real life Matt Hooper.
I don't know about that, but I guess in a way. So.
I like thinking of you like that.
Yeah, yeah.
You're the real-life Richard Dreyfuss character.
The real guy, yeah.
If you're just joining us, we're talking to Dave Ebert, Program Director for the Pacific Shark Research Center at the Moss Landing Marine Laboratories. We'll be back to find out more about the fascinating shark family and their roles in the world's oceans after a short break. I'm Dave Shlohm, and you are listening to Blue Dot. And we're back, and thanks for listening. Let's return now to our conversation with the lost shark guy, Dave Ebert, director of the Pacific Shark Research Center at the Moss Landing Marine Laboratories. There's so many, but give us a few of your favorite sharks that people probably have never heard of.
Oh, things like, you know, I bring up things like a goblin shark, for example. This is a shark that gets, it can grow pretty large, up to about 20 feet or so. It's a deep sea shark. But I always tell people, like, here's a shark, you know, when I ask people like, what colors you think sharks are? Most people think like kind of dark brown, blackish, gray. Here's a shark that in life it's pink with blue fins. And wow. So that kind of gets people's attention. Like, whoa, that's kind of interesting. So that's one of the more interesting species I have. Or I talk about a lot of these little are called shy sharks. They're kind of, a lot of them are endemic to South Africa and they're really pretty little sharks. They're very colorful, have variegated color patterns. And again, I show people pictures of these things because they just let people know, like, sharks can come in a whole array of different colors. And so I try to show them like they're not all these species, just sort of a drab color. And that's, which is another thing, is a lot of times when people see sharks, they are dead and they've been sitting on the dock or on a boat for a few hours and they don't look that good. They kind of fade out with the colors. But if you see them, sharks in life, and even these little sharks get maybe a foot and a half to 2 feet, these little shy sharks, they're just some of the most prettiest sharks you'll ever see. So those are some of the ones I like to show, I talk to people about, or things like some people might recognize like a thresher shark, which has a tail as long as its body trunk. And they use that to like catch small fishes. They'll swim through a school of fish and whip their tail and kill and stun a lot of fish species. And then they just come back around and consume them. So some species have these interesting structures like the long tail for catching their prey items.
And sharks literally live in almost all parts of the ocean. Is that correct?
Yeah. You got them from the polar regions to the tropics. They live in coastal areas. They live in the open ocean, the deep sea. There are even some sharks that occupy freshwater habitats. So they're quite, they occupy most habitats globally.
Yeah. And as you look back on your career, who are some of the great shark scientists that you would point to as, you know, your mentors or people you really looked up to? I think of, like, you know, when I think of shark science, I think of names like John McCosker from the Steinhardt Aquarium. People like, who are some of your heroes?
Well, I got to tell you, John McCosker, who was a former director of the Steinhardt Aquarium, he was the guy that kind of launched me early on, because I was, when I first got into graduate school, I was looking around for what to do, and I was talking to my professor at Moss Landing, who was another one of the three. John McCosker was probably one of the three guys that had the big influence in my early career. And although, let me start with John, I went up and talked to him, just went up and talked to him, didn't know him anything, introduced myself. And I told him what I was really wanted to do. Some, I was looking to do an ecology study, and I wanted to do some kind of shark that nobody had studied. And he goes, well, there's these seven-gill sharks that occur out here in San Francisco Bay. They're really common. We don't know anything about them. And I was like, great. So I said, I'm going to go work on seven-gill sharks. Well, I went back down to Moss Landing Marine Laboratories, which was another guy who was probably one of the most influential people in my career, was Greg Caye. He was a professor in ichthyology. He was one of the really guys that started the whole area of shark age and growth studies. And he'd started up this whole shark research program here just before I arrived at Moss Landing. So I went down and talked to him. I said, went to his office, I was all excited. I said, Greg, I'm going to study seven-gill sharks. And he looks at me, he goes, you mean Notorhynchus? And I just kind of shrugged my shoulders. I go, I don't know, what's that? And he goes, get out of my office and don't come in here unless you know the scientific name and you're prepared to talk about a project. So I kind of slumped down and shuffled out of the office there. But I learned I tell this story because it's a valuable lesson, that I was excited about the whole thing, but I didn't prepare to go in there. And so he made the point, like, why are you wasting your time and my time if you're not prepared to sit down and let's have a serious discussion about your project? And it was something I've carried through life since then, that I was, every time I would go see him or anybody else, I get prepared now. But I learned a ton of stuff from him. And then, of course, the third person I mentioned earlier, Leonard Compagno, he was like that, as I talk about in my journey in life sometimes, that sort of fellow traveler you run into if you're very fortunate in your career, who was like, he had been on the same path that I was just starting on, but he was obviously further down the road. And so he was that sort of Sherpa, that guy early on in my career that really was influential in my career. And so, yeah, John McCosker, Greg Caye, and Leonard Compagno were probably the three most certainly influential people that really helped me in my career.
And now you get to play that role as a mentor for young research scientists. Tell us, what do you most enjoy about working with your students?
The coolest thing is, like, I try to instill the same thing that the people I mentioned did. Like, well, you know, here's some ideas. I'll give them some ideas and some thoughts and stuff. And then I'm like, okay, go figure out what you want to do. Because the exciting thing to me is having them come back and say, hey, Dave, what about this, this, or this? Like, well, that sounds kind of cool. Or, that may not work, but go ahead and try it. And so I'm kind of in that role now where I have students go out there and they'll come up with some ideas. I mean, I'll give them some parameters or something, or maybe, hey, here's a species we don't know anything about. Why don't you go try and work on that? And I try to, I think, especially because I've been in this career now almost 40 years, it's like I think that, because every day is kind of like Christmas for me. And I think I like to instill that enthusiasm in my students. And I think most of them get that from me. It's kind of infectious. And so they get really excited about it. And, you know, a lot of them have kind of hung in there. You know, it's hard in the field to stay in doing sharks your whole career and stuff, but just as you go through, you learn those skills in life where you just want to be enthusiastic about whatever it is you end up pursuing in life. But yeah, working with students is great. It keeps me young, that's for sure.
And I saw you made a comment, and I'd like you to elaborate on it before we let you go here. I thought it was very profound, where you said, you know, in science, you can kind of go one of two ways. You can be an explorer or a settler. Explain what you mean by that.
Yep. Well, I always kind of set it up like, you know, when you go out, if you're going to go out and pursue whatever career you can follow the herd or swim with the school or do what everybody else is doing, you know, or you can think outside the box, take your own path, you know, the road less traveled, to quote Robert Frost, and to make it a journey to explore something, because, you know, it's sort of like stepping off into the unknown, because, you know, if you knew what was coming next, it wouldn't be an adventure. It wouldn't be an exploration. And so it's that, you know, I put this to my students, like, do you want to be an explorer or a settler? Do you want to go out and do something new, something that no one else is doing, or do you want to just do what everybody else is doing? And sometimes I'll put it in the context, like, well, everybody does white sharks these days. Do you want to be just one another face in the crowd, or do you want to stand out in the crowd? Do you want to stand on the shoulders of giants and move forward and advance the field? And that's where the explorer is.
With your lifetime passion for sharks, give us your elevator speech of why sharks are so important and shark conservation is, you know, something you're passionate about.
I have to say, it wasn't shark conservation initially drove me. I was just fascinated by these sharks. I just thought they were the coolest things I'd ever seen. But as I kind of got along now in the conservation area, I realized just how important these sharks are really to the health of the ecosystem, literally. And because of their status as high-level predators, they have an influence on the rest of the marine community and the ecosystem. And if you remove these things, it's just like taking out, you know, your building blocks in a home. If you take out the foundation, your home's going to collapse. If you take out these sharks, your ecosystems are going to likely collapse.
Well, Dave Ebert, shark expert extraordinaire, program director for the Pacific Shark Research Center at Moss Landing Laboratories, thanks for sharing just some of your amazing knowledge about these creatures of the oceans that are so important to the marine ecosystem. It's been really fun to talk to you. Thank you.
Thank you, Dave. Appreciate it.
Thanks again to our guest, Program Director of the Pacific Shark Research Center at Moss Landing Marine Laboratories, David Ebert. You can learn more about Dave's work by checking out his website, lostsharkguide.com. Blue Dot is a production of North State Public Radio, a service of Cap Radio in beautiful and talented Northern California. We're distributed by PRX. If you want to revisit, share, or check out past episodes, you can do just that on our website, mynspr.org. And while you're at it, subscribe to our podcast so you never miss an episode on our website, the NPR One app, or wherever you get your podcast groove on. Our theme music, Big Wave Dave, is by Matt Schiltz. Blue Dot is engineered and produced by the maestro, Matt Fidler. For all of us here, I remind you there that from deep space, we all live on a pale blue dot.